welcome to Dialect. I'm Angela Balassi. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002 and goes out every Tuesday lunchtime at 12 noon here on BCFM 93.2. This week we have an interview with Felix Bender of North Light Solutions, a former senior army officer who talks about dealing with conflict, and Fraser Stewart, who worked in a job centre and what it taught him about the benefits system. We'll also have an interview with a blacksmith called Simon Summers. Dialect is produced by volunteers. If you want to join in, contact Volunteering Bristol, who are just off Queen Square. You can call them on 0117 989 7733 or visit them on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. And I'll repeat those contact details at the end of the show. We will be speaking to a former senior army officer who was sent on peacekeeping missions to Kosovo and Iraq. Felix Spender, who also helped secure the release of Somalian pirates hostages, talks about the cost of conflict and how it's best avoided. He has now set up North Light Solutions to help resolve conflict in everyday life. Hello, Felix. Thank you for joining us.
Hello, Angela.
Firstly, could you tell me why you set up North Light Solutions?
When I left the army, I wanted to do something that was interesting and would keep me going. And I had no wish to get the 7:15 up to Basingstoke every morning. I also needed to find something that would be suitable for my own transferable skills, because I didn't really have the time in life to retrain again in something entirely new. And I think thirdly, I had seen conflict during my time in the army and had seen how very damaging our adversarial approach was, and thought, there has to be another way of doing this. There has to be another collaborative and consensual approach to solving these problems. And that's what North Light Solutions is all about.
And what is the cost of conflict, do you think?
The cost of conflict is horrendous. Globally, the Institute of Economics and Peace estimates that 13% of world GDP is lost in conflict. I've no idea what that translates into lives ruined, but that is a huge amount. And then individually down at business level, the Chartered Institute of Professional Development says that individuals involved in conflict in organisations, they lose 25% of productivity. So conflict is really eking out somewhere between 13 and 25% of productivity in businesses and organisations.
And of course, there's the loss of lives, which I can't imagine we can put a number on. Do you not think, though, it's against the grain for somebody who's served in the army for over 30 years to now look for peaceful resolutions?
You might think that, Angela. And it's true that in the army, at the very top end of what we did, it was the controlled application of violence to achieve the military goals. But then actually a vast amount of what we did was collaborative. It was about solving problems, and the way you solve problems is by working as teams through good collaboration. And in my experience, I think we achieved far more through good collaborative work than we did through the fighting and the adversarial approach.
And what was your time in the army like?
I loved it. Yeah. I had a great time. I mean, I joined at the age of 18. I joined a regiment called the Royal Irish Rangers, now the Royal Irish Regiment, which is undoubtedly one of the finest regiments in the British Army. I had a career that spanned the two eras of the Cold War and then the post-Cold War conflicts. The Cold War period was fascinating, where we were based in Germany as part of a huge British garrison over there. During that time, we served in Berlin, which again was at that point in the Cold War when Ronald Reagan was declaring the evil empire and all these sorts of dynamics were going on. And then that was interspersed with trips to Northern Ireland. So that was the first part of my career. And then after that, we moved into the post-Cold War conflicts in the Balkans and in the Middle East. And that brought a completely different dynamic, a completely different approach to what was going on, and a completely different experience.
And you were in Germany at the time of the fall of the Berlin Wall, I believe.
I was. I remember the exact time the announcement went out and what I was doing. And it was a fascinating period because no one knew what was going to happen. We knew the old order had gone, the Soviet bloc and the Warsaw Pact had, you know, essentially broken up, and no one knew quite what was going to come after it. And it was a time of expectation, I think, and uncertainty, because the building blocks of that which we had been used to had disappeared.
And you also served in Northern Ireland. What was that like?
Northern Ireland was an eye-opener. I mean, that was my very first operational tour. And I was very young. I think I was about 19, very callow youth. And one went there with various ideas and expectations. And I think for me, it was the first time I'd ever met people who genuinely hated me, not me personally, but for the uniform I wore. And, you know, people would say, well, why didn't you expect that? The answer is because one was very naive and had never experienced this before. And it came as a shock.
During your time in the army, what did it teach you about conflict management?
I think a number of things, a huge number of things, actually. There are always two sides to a story. In fact, there are probably more than two sides to a story. And the narrative is never simple. I think that facts, in people's minds, facts are less relevant than perception. So what they perceive to be the truth is more important to them than the actual truth. And I think, and this will sound strange coming from someone who's dealt with people in the military, but I would say that people are individuals, and we make this error of labelling people as groups. You know, we label them as the military, we label them as the people of Bristol, we label them, give all these sorts of labels to people, and we forget that actually the label is largely meaningless. It's one we apply. Inside, there are individuals, and each individual has a view, has an agenda, has values, and has to be treated like an individual.
And you then retired from the army in 2010 and worked as a consultant for Begbie's Trainer Group, which is a global risk and investigation service. And I understand here you mainly dealt with cases of Somalian pirates holding people hostage, working to release those on board the ships and also manage the crisis for the ship owners. Could you tell me what this experience was like?
It was another fascinating experience. I was working as a consultant for Begbie Trainers Global Risk Partners at the time, who were a subdivision of Begbie Trainers Group. It was a time when the Somali piracy was at its height and running out of control. The international measures had yet to be put in place. And the problem was that Somalia was ungoverned, largely ungoverned space, and therefore it was an ideal refuge point. I think at the time I joined the operation, there were something like 20 to 30 ships held as hostages and something in the region of 700 merchant seamen held by the pirates. So it was a very difficult time indeed. I think what was brilliant about it is you never knew where you would go next. You never knew where you would be based when you did the jobs. And you'd get a phone call from the company who would say, you know, Felix, we've got something breaking. Can you go to Germany or Tokyo or Greece tomorrow and take on the case? And so you went. And it was very interesting because you had to turn up at the office of the ship owners, and from the moment you walked through that door, you had to be the expert, and you had to exude a level of confidence and competence that you would be able to solve their problem while at the same time managing their expectations with this group of people who you'd never met, you may not have anything in common with, but you had to turn it on from the very moment you walked through the door. So that was exciting.
I imagine it was also quite tense. Was that the case?
Yeah. I mean, it went through... Because the cases went on for quite a long time, so the shortest one I did was 65 days, which was considered a real result, a really good result. And then the longest one went on for 8 months, which was very difficult, very complex. It would go through periods of intense work, intense activity, quite a lot of periods of boredom as well, and then there would be periods of high tension, and you could never quite predict what was going to happen when. So you thought you might be moving through a period of long and prolonged inactivity, and then suddenly something would happen and you'd have this incredibly tense couple of days where you had to resolve an issue, and then it might subside again. So it was, yeah, it was very tense at times.
I imagine it was also a lot of responsibility, because you were responsible for people's lives on board, weren't you, the hostages?
I mean, there was a very serious element to it, and you were very conscious that you were responsible for the safety of the crew. There might be 20 or 30 crewmen on these ships. You were conscious that every move that you made, or that the company made, the shipping company made, would be interpreted at the far end, and that would have an impact on the individuals who were held hostage. And so you were playing this, at times, a very real game of three-dimensional chess.
And were your own values ever compromised?
I think throughout the course of my life, my values have been challenged quite frequently. And I think the art is to learn how to be pragmatic, and how do you get the task done without compromising your own values. And I think that's sometimes quite difficult, actually, and there is a fine line to draw. I think for us, you know, the concept of giving money to criminal extortionists certainly challenged our values.
And I imagine you were sometimes dealing with people who were probably quite unpleasant. How did you cope with that?
I think you have to go back to this thing of being, so long as you have faith in the task, so long as you believe in the task, then you have to accept that you're going to work with people who are, you know, may well be quite unpleasant in a number of different ways. And again, it's this question of being pragmatic about it, not succumbing to their values, but also taking your own personal feelings and putting them in a little box, so that you know your personal distaste for these individuals doesn't show through. And so you have to bracket your individual feelings and then work pragmatically and avoid compromising yourself.
And I imagine during the time in the army and also working as a consultant, that your life or other lives are at risk. How does it compare today to the work you do?
It doesn't compare on the same scale. It's as serious, because the work we do is relating to keeping businesses fit and healthy. And I think, you know, if businesses collapse, then people lose their jobs. So there is that element to it, which actually we don't forget. I wouldn't compare it with the same decisions of my former life.
And how do you help organisations today deal with conflict?
Our task is to help businesses and organisations deal with the very debilitating effects of conflict and change. And the way we do that is by ensuring that their individuals and their teams and their projects run as smoothly as possible, by trying to remove the grit from the various bits of mechanism that hold it back, so that we know that if project teams are not working well together because they're in disagreement, the project will start to flounder. And actually what we do is we act as impartial and neutral facilitators, for want of a better word, to identify where the conflict friction points are, and then help the businesses develop ways of managing those conflicts so that they can be more efficient.
And do businesses always recognise they have an issue with conflict?
No, I don't think they do. And I think it's what I call the dripping tap syndrome. You can have a tap dripping in your bathroom, and you can, every day when you go in to brush your teeth, you hear it drip, 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 and you think, I must do something about that. But you never do, because it's an effort to call the plumber, it's going to cost some money, and so you don't. And so the dripping tap keeps dripping for days, weeks, months. And I think that's the case with this, is that the conflict is there, people get used to it, it becomes systemic to the business, and they sort of, it's just in the background. And what they don't realise is that if they dealt with that conflict, you know, they could be a lot healthier.
And save money in the long run, I imagine.
And save money. Yeah.
And once a conflict has been resolved, what differences do you see?
I think it's fantastic. I mean, I think when we see it happening, you see these businesses that have had great talent and great organisation and great efficiency running, and it just, but they've been held back by these breaks of conflict. And it's just like releasing the brakes, and they start to accelerate forward. And so they become more productive, they become more innovative, people become happier, you know, you get better performance. I mean, it is brilliant when you see it happen. And I think, you know, rather than going through long and involved legal processes or just tolerating what's been going on, it's just a nice, speedy way of dealing with it.
Thank you, Felix. And where can people find out more about Northlight Solutions?
They can look at us up on our website, which is northlightsolutions.com. And on there, you'll find a nice video that we've just been put up, made by another Bristol company. So we're really pleased with that.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
We'll be speaking to Fraser Stewart, who has written a blog called What My Job in a UK Job Centre Told Me About Today's Benefit System. He quit his job in 2010 when the coalition government took office. He said his role changed from getting people into work to cutting the welfare bill by any means. Fraser is a columnist with Common Space, Scotland's political social media hub. Hello, Fraser. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Cheers.
You worked in a job centre for 18 months before the coalition government took office. What was it like?
Yeah. It was great. It was really, really good. It was eye-opening as well to sort of experience the reality of it, to sort of extinguish some of the myths that were surrounding it. It was great to work with people and to help people in that kind of sort of fundamental ways.
What sort of issues did they have then?
Typically, well, naturally it was sort of meeting their bills at the end of the month and finding work. A lot of it was lone parent work and things like that as well. So it was pretty severe circumstances in a lot of cases. So it was gratifying, to say the least, to help people in that kind of predicament.
So why did you quit?
It was entirely down to being handed targets for sanctions from the coalition government. Now, you can't sort of blame the management and the staff in there as such. But yeah, I couldn't be the person that was stopping people's money by any means because I had a target to meet. My circumstances shouldn't dictate somebody else's.
And what do you mean by a sanction?
A sanction as in getting people off their benefits, either cutting their benefit completely or sanction, say, a two-week stopping of their money.
What kind of targets did you have?
The targets varied. They wanted us to get one person per fraud per month, one person for actively seeking employment per week. Now, actively seeking employment, that's the job centre diary, where they write down where they've looked for work, what jobs they've applied for and stuff like that. It was to catch people out to catch them out for not looking for work. Essentially, that was what we were told we had to do.
And was that something that was easy to do?
Oh, no, God, no. I think for some people it might have been easy, some people that had been, I don't know, maybe institutionalised, I guess, by working there for such a long time. But no, it's not something I could have stomached, certainly not.
But did these people exist? Was it a case of there was one fraud per month, one case of somebody not seeking work? Or was it simply ticking boxes?
Essentially, yeah, it was. So if someone came in who maybe they'd had a tough week and they hadn't had a chance to, or they just hadn't written it down in their diary, or they were, a lot of the time I was seeing people getting sanctioned for being late for appointments or missing appointments. But when you think, if someone can't afford a bus fare because you've stopped their money previously, and then you're going to kick them off benefits for eternity because they can't make it into appointment because you've stopped their money, it's just, it doesn't work like that. That's not feasible. It's cruel in many, many ways.
I think figures showed that between October 2012 and September 2014, that a quarter of a million of job seeker claimants were sanctioned for missing just a single appointment. And that is according to the government's own figures. What do you make of that?
I think that's probably the best example of it. I don't know if you've had a look at the figures either. They're very, very convoluted. But it's that kind of thing. That's people hitting targets without even having to face the person whose money they're cutting. It's so mechanical. It completely dehumanizes the person whose money's getting stopped because they don't ever have to interact with them. All they have to do is tick a box and say, did not turn up for an appointment. And then they receive a letter saying, you have been sanctioned for missing your appointment. It's dehumanizing. I think, yeah, that's the best way to put it.
And could they appeal?
Originally, when I started there, there was an appeals process. But as such, they can appeal, but there's no compensation over that time of appeal. They can apply for a crisis loan, but if they get denied that, then there's nothing. There is no alternative for people whatsoever during the appeals process, which in some cases can take up to 4 weeks if it's highly contested.
So what effect did this have on these people?
Oh, devastating. Absolutely devastating. That was when I was first introduced to the sort of unemployed workers network, a campaign group in Scotland. These people were having to come down and help the people whose money had been stopped, help them sort of converse because they couldn't get their words out through, be it tears or anger or, it was absolutely devastating. And you think that's before you even get into the effect it had in their households. Are they able to pay their rent? Do they have electricity? Are they able to feed their families and stuff? It's horrific, absolutely horrific.
And in your blog, you talk about the sanction to suicide figures. Do you have any figures for this, or do you believe there's a correlation?
I don't have any figures personally. I can't. There have been a few cases in Dundee that I'm aware of that have been raised, that have been protested against, that have been that have sparked protest, I guess. But none. I don't have any official nationwide statistics at all.
And can you tell me what kind of people you were dealing with?
Largely speaking, normal people like myself, yourself, anyone. I was having a conversation actually just earlier today, and it's just normal. Anyone you meet in the street, anyone you see in the queue for the tube, any manner of people. Very, very rarely did you get anyone who seemed sort of actively idle, or who was addicted to drugs, or who had a criminal past. That was a very, very rare thing. I would go as far as to say of my own clientele, it was 95% just your standard normal people who had found themselves in a bit of a tricky position.
Because I think in your blog you say they ranged from joiners and cleaners to neurobiologists and architects and so on, and it was just basically people who'd, you know, had a difficult time.
It is. It's like a lot of it, maybe not a huge percentage, but I recall a lot of people coming out with graduate level and postgraduate level degrees, and they just couldn't get a job at the end of it. They had nowhere else to go because they couldn't get themselves into the line of employment they wanted to get into. That's not like the stigma that goes along with sort of criminals or lazy or scroungers or they're less educated in some way. It's just absolutely ridiculous. It really is.
In your opinion, were these people actively looking for employment?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I find it very, very hard to believe. And there's evidence to support this as well. If you look at like the Roundtree Foundation and the trade unions and things like that, all their research, there is very, very little evidence to support any idea that anyone doesn't want to work. I think even people that might say it are saying it largely out of a place of maybe it's depression, maybe it's sort of self-loathing, maybe it's just that kind of, they've gotten to the stage now where they've been so ground down by the whole process that they're struggling to find the motivation. And that's one of the issues with the sanctions process and with the benefits stigmatization in general, is that it grinds people down to make them think that they are in some way worth less than people who are in employment.
Well, the government, what do they use as evidence when they introduce these sanctions? What do they say you had to look for as evidence that people weren't looking for work?
The evidence is the writing in the diary. Towards, just as I was leaving, it was, you were, the job centre website, they have like codes per job. So whenever a benefit claimant applied for a job through the job centre website, the advisor would see the code popping up. So there was no way that they could lie about it, I guess. Not that they were lying in the first place. The other one was, like I said, just writing in the diary. So because someone could have went out and handed the CDs in to two dozen shops and not written it in their diary because they've forgotten to. And that would be classed by the job centre advisor as being enough to declare not actively seeking employment.
What do you think of the notion of Benefits Britain?
Oh, it's rubbish. It's absolutely rubbish. It makes me exacerbated being asked about it and talking about it just in general because it's sensationalist. It's a media idea. It's something people watch shows like that because it makes them feel better about their own lives. That's why people watch shows like that, and that's why they garner so much popularity, and it becomes this sort of populist idea, a complete myth founded on nothing at all other than a few very very small samples of sort of case studies of this one street in the UK where poverty is really high and most of the people on the street claim benefits. That doesn't mean that the UK is full of streets like that. That's a tiny proportion of benefit claimants in general. It's something that needs to be challenged as well. Politicians aren't doing enough to challenge that ideology.
But even if it is a minority, would you recognise that some people are long-term unemployed and sometimes it is a case of more than one generation in a family?
Oh, there is. I cannot. There are figures to show that. I can't deny that. I can't argue with the facts of it. And it would be very romantic of me to say, well, everyone's a thoroughly hardworking person and everyone has a desire to work. Because there are some people in the world that don't want to, that just don't want, that are happy to live off the state. But I defy anyone to prove that is the vast majority as opposed to the distinct minority of claimants in the UK.
And some people would argue that capping the benefits to £20,000, for example, in London, is more than what some working people could earn, especially after they have to commute and pay other costs. What would you say to those who say the benefit system does not offer an incentive to work?
I would say that I can see the point of that argument. I can see the point. But then that's where the net widens. That's where it becomes less about, well, how much money are we giving people on benefits? It becomes more about, well, why aren't we paying our workers more? That's where the thing is. So the incentive to get into work, they can earn more money being in work than being on benefits. That's just fact. People's situations vary. But it needs to be, that's more an argument to raise wages as opposed to capping welfare. It's this sort of race to the bottom for everything under the Conservative government. It should be about increasing wages, increasing prosperity rather than austerity, and making it easier for people to get into work and make it easier for people to live when they are in work. In-work poverty is a huge problem as well. That's something that needs to be addressed and can only be addressed by increasing the wage.
So what would you like to see happen?
I would like to see a bit of realism in the dialogue rather than any political party or politician coming out and saying that we want to lower taxes purely because it's popular. I'd like them to come out and say, well, we want to raise taxes, but we also want to raise wages to make everyone better off. People in work would be better off, the economy would be better off with a higher tax system as well. I want to see someone challenge the dialogue that just because it's popular to lower taxes, that's what you have to do to win elections.
And would you like to scrap these sanctions and targets for the job centre, for example?
I would love to see targets scrapped entirely. I would like to see sanctions scrapped as well. Probably moving to maybe, I don't know, the Swedish model is quite strong in the way it's set up, based partly on contributions, but there's no sanctions procedure. You use that as you need it. It's limited. I can't remember the exact limit on it, but you use it as much as you need it. And I'm pretty sure it's about 2 years worth, which is, after 2 years, that's long-term unemployed. That's where you separate the people who don't want to work from the vast majority of everyone else. That's how that works.
Where can people read more about your blog, for example?
They can read my columns weekly. Usually they come out on a Tuesday. Very occasionally they'll come out on other days on thecommonspace.scot. Or they can read an archive of my old posts on fraserjfstewart.wordpress.com.
Well, thank you, Fraser. Thank you for joining us.
No problem at all. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And now for the interview Tony Gosling did with the blacksmith Simon Summers.
My name is Simon Summers. I'm a blacksmith. I specialise in heritage blacksmithing, and I've come here to share my skills and my craft with the folk that come to the festival. The Iron Age people, or even before that, you know, going back into time, nature was a really important part of their lifestyle because they're actually living out in nature. So some of the finds that archaeologists have found, you know, beautiful treasures of nature in them, like the spiral, you'll see as ferns unravel as they grow in the spring, they're all coiled up and they unravel. Snail shells and so on, and lots of sea creatures, what they were seeing, these beautiful shapes and things from nature all around them, they embraced, and then you could see it in their craftsmanship. We're using steel here, but sometimes we use iron that I've smelted beforehand, but there's quite a hard process involved with that. So the Iron Age people would have smelted their own iron from like iron ore rock and smelted the iron content out of that in a furnace. We do that, but what you just saw me forging was a piece of mild steel. It was about 6 millimeter round diameter, and then I've had to forge it out into a square taper, then knock the corners off that square taper into an octagonal taper, then knock the corners off the octagonal to make it round. Then you've got like a needle, and then I've rolled up the needle. So not only have you can see the spiral coiling up, but you're actually seeing the thickness of the material. From a really thin needle point coming into a thicker, wider piece of material, so it's more effective. And that's all done with the hammer on the anvil and doing it by eye and by hand, understanding and training your eye and hand to form metal just with a hammer on an anvil. And you can do amazing things with that technique, and that's what they've done for thousands of years, you know.
So how do you actually, and how did they originally heat the iron, as it originally was, up to the temperature where you can start to work it?
Well, what we've done here is we've recreated that whole environment. I've bought clay from Devon, where I'm based in Totnes. So we've brought the clay up here and we've mixed it with sharp sand and straw to build a forge on the floor. And then we've got leather bellows blasting the air into the forge.
Well, you're calling it a forge. I mean, it looks to me like two sort of long mountains of clay that you just put on the floor here and you've got the fire in between them.
That's right. It looks like two embankments of clay, like two walls. So you've got the front and the back wall. The air is coming through the back wall into the area in between.
So one of the walls has got a hole in it and you've got these two pipes coming from two bellows to go right into the middle of the fire.
That's right, yeah. And the front wall is to keep the charcoal in place because charcoal's very light. So if you've got air blasting into it, if we didn't have that front wall, the charcoal would just blast out and blow everywhere. So those two walls are retaining an area that can keep the charcoal in one location. And then both ends are open, so you can slide a piece of material, it could be iron or copper or anything you like, into the fire. You could make a sword in that fire, and then you get the spot heat right where the air goes into the charcoal. So you can move your material up and down into the fire to get the heat where you want it. So it's like very controlled, compact, clean way of forging. Yeah, so we call that a forge fire. If we was to smelt iron, we would build another clay structure, but it would be in a furnace, so it would be like a conical chimney sort of shape with a door in the middle and the airflow again going into it at a certain point, and then you would have like an open chimney where you'd put the charcoal charge and the iron ore deposits in, and they all find each other. Once the charcoal burns away, the iron ore finds each other. So it's a similar sort of setup. The four main elements, we've got earth, and we're using clay, or you know, like to build the forge, so that's the earth. We're using the air, which is the bellows, to breathe into the fire. Then of course we've got the fire to heat up the iron to forge it, and then we've got a water source to quench the iron afterwards. So we actually working and embracing with the four elements of nature there. If you think of right early on, we talk about like Neolithic times, and that's like more Stone Age, and then we got the Bronze Age, and then it goes into the Iron Age. But before the Bronze Age, they obviously discovered, when they've been mining and digging and exploring what materials and sources there are around them, to move forward in production of different tools, you know, from a flint axe, for instance, to this new bronze axe. But before they discovered bronze, they discovered copper and then tin.
And these metals were discovered just simply from getting rocks which had that oxide in and smelting it, heating those rocks up in a conventional fire and finding that actually metal would run out. I mean, how does that actually... I mean, is that something you can do at home? You've said that you've got a furnace at home, but it has to be heated up pretty hot, does it?
Yeah, basically, no, you couldn't just do this at home. You have to understand a little bit of the metallurgy. And when we think about the old times, they wouldn't have done this in a fiery way. It was quite a dangerous thing to do. The gases that would be released from this smelting, they would basically go into caves which had no ventilation. They would be going in total darkness and they would be building massive fires to actually draw the material out of the rock. The gases from that, the fumes would be quite dangerous. So no, it's not something you can do at home. That moved on. They would actually extract the rock and break it down with hammers to get most of the rock out of the way, the stone that's protecting the mineral that they were after. They would build clay furnaces to put as pure as they could iron ore into the furnace. And then what would happen when it get up to temperature, all of the impurities would separate, and we call that a slag. We drain off the furnace to release those waste products in a liquid form. It looks like actually liquid gold pouring out, and that's the waste. And then what you've got left in there is the sticky toffee, which is the stuff that you're after. That's with iron, but with copper that's a little bit different. But when they found copper and tin, they blended them together, and then you've got bronze. That's what bronze is, copper and tin. So then they got this hard metal, because copper is very malleable and ductile. If they made an axe out of it, it would pretty, you know, like it would stay, you know, sharp for a little while, but it would become blunt and bend quite easily. So if you hammer a piece of copper, you can work hard in it, and that was the only way of like keeping it hard. Because if you heated it up and quenched it like you were doing up with iron, you're actually annealing the copper, so it's very malleable and soft, like plasticine basically. But I add in tin, that gave it a strength, and then the Bronze Age kicked off, and then they could start making axes with bronze. And then when the Iron Age period came, they've discovered this new metal, superseded basically the bronze, but the bronze had its uses. And that's where another element of what I do is, because I'm very much like entwined with the Bronze Age and Iron Age. The Iron Age was like this new material which would stay sharper longer, and they could forge it. That you can forge bronze. Forging is actually when you like you're using a hammer and you're actually forging the material
on the anvil.
Yeah. So like when you're talking about molds, that would be another thing. That's when they started to cast bronze, and they found that brass was this amazing material that they could put in a crucible into a furnace to get it into a liquid content, and then they could pour it into molds that they've made. So that was a different element there. But what I've actually focused on, copper on its own or bronze, there's a type of work where you hammer the work. It's like embossing from both sides, and it's called, the term is called repoussé. So with the copper, you can work on one side, then the other, and start bashing out shapes. You could bash out a face, and you're just basically working with really primitive tools on a little oak stump with hammers and simple little tools that I forged in that little clay fire forge that we talked about earlier on. And then the copper starts to work hard, and if you carry on working it, it split and cracks. So we can put it in the forge again and get it to a cherry red, then quench it in the water, and then it's malleable and ductile over again. Then we can push it out even more and more and more. So they were doing that in bronze and copper, and making cauldrons that archaeologists are finding these days, that were in burial sites and such like. These beautiful treasures. So not only have they gone and mined the material, then smelted it, then they've hammered it out into a sheet, and then they've carried out this repoussé work into amazing treasures. So that's another element of what I do. You know, like it comes in with the blacksmithing side of it. Just looking at any Celtic books on treasures that have been found, you'll see repoussé over and over again, as well as the forge work. So they were really advanced in doing amazing things in simple, primitive workshops with a clay fire on the ground, like we've got here with leather bellows. They were had furnaces running, they're smelting iron, and then they're forging it into tools. I did some really advanced heritage training with a chap called Paul Allen. He was showing us how to make all our own tools with the hammer on the anvil. If you see things like gates in cathedrals and churches and such like, these beautiful gates are all hand-forged with a hammer on an anvil. And instead of using any electronic welding equipment or fabrication, drills, angle grinders, anything like that, we've been trained to use the hammer and the anvil and the fire to forge tenon joints like you would see in woodwork, to fire weld, and that fire weld or forge welding is to join two bits of metal together to become one, using no electrical tools at all, just using the skill of fire management and then the anvil and the hammer and then riveting. So that's the ancient way of working with the metal that was trained, and repoussé was an element of that. So then you think, like, where could you see repoussé work which you could earn money? Because in the olden days it was making sacred offerings, and that could have been a job for somebody to make something for royalty, in a clan or a chieftain or something, some special shield that was part of their family. So today, if we was to look at those skills and where they could be used, if you see things like weather vanes on churches and cathedrals, and they're three-dimensional, they are made in two halves most of the time, and they're hand-beaten copper repoussé and then silver-soldered together or riveted together, and then the iron work, which is the compass points in north, south, east, west, is forged iron work with tenon joints and fire welded graceful scrolls that are unraveling. So you've got that nature that the ancient people in the Bronze Age and Iron Age were creating in their work. You see that in gates, you're seeing plant life unraveling and uncoiling, and the Greeks were the first people to start. You would see on their pillars and such of their structures, camphor sleeves and scrolls and nature uncoiling and unraveling. So going right back in tissue, they were carving that into stone, and then you started seeing that happening in forge work. And in Victorian times, in Edwardian times, that was especially into Edwardian times, it was in its peak of hand craftsmanship throughout all of the other crafts and raw industries. The blacksmith made his own tools, and he made all of the other tools for all of the other crafts. He made the hinges for the church gate, he made the miner's pick, and he made the needle for the tailor to sew, and the sword, the arrow, and everything else that you can think of. The woodcarver's chisel, the stonemason's chisel, the stonemason's tools. It went on and on and on. So the blacksmith was the heart of the village.
Do you find that there's still practical demand? I mean, most people think of it possibly blacksmithing as something which is still used for shoeing horses and for horsework. But is there any other kind of practical stuff which is you find that there's still a demand for?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a separation now with shoeing horses. Back in the day, when we were using horses on the road everywhere instead of cars and vehicles, the shoes would have been forged by the blacksmith and fitted. Nowadays, there's quite a separation, because you have to understand the veterinary side of the horse's hoof, and it's not just ordinary blacksmith could do. It's a specialised training for a farrier. I most certainly can forge a horseshoe, but fitting it's another thing. But with regard to the heritage side of work and the training that I've been through, all of that heritage that we have in this country, and that could be a castle or a cathedral or a stone circle or anything like that, where there's any ironwork that has been made in the past, we need to upkeep that maintained as part of our heritage for our country. And that could be the stonework on the cathedral, it could be the weather vane, it could be the gates, it could be any ironwork. So the heritage, and working with organisations like English Heritage and the National Trust that are protecting our heritage. And I've recreated this Iron Age forge setting to make people feel that they're in the right environment to feel at ease, sitting on a sheepskin, leather clay, forge, and primitive tools. Just a piece of copper or a piece of iron can be forged into beautiful things, practical and decorative. We're all talking about going green, but when you think of going back to the old ways, now I'm using charcoal, a clay forge, and we're basically in the middle of a field and we're making treasures here, or tools. In a simple, gentle way.
What's your thoughts about how healthy this craft is as something that should be being retained as a community memory?
What is really valuable about most certainly my craft that I feel very passionate about is that if the steel industries, steel mills and things like that get less and less and less, and we can't buy ready-made material because the sources are running dry or it's costing too much to do that. As a blacksmith, if you bought me an old broken horseshoe on a cobbled lane, I could reforge it into something else. I can take car components like leaf springs and high carbon steel that's used in car parts when they go to scrap, it can be reforged into tools. So if there was that turning point where it flipped over, where we were struggling as a nation, the blacksmith can still make the tools, going back like we did. So if it came to that, instead of we don't have to go and necessarily mine those minerals that we talked about earlier, the blacksmith can take what we've got kicking around all over the place and reforge it into something else. Like, I've got a heavy horse myself, and after the horseshoes are done with on the horse, I can reforge those into new things. We call that recycling. I can change the hinge that's broken of the gate into something completely different, like fire welded chain links. So it's got two sides to it. Yeah, you could either go with the flow of what's happening and embrace it, or you can support how it could change for the better, it could be, or it could be maybe for the worse that we think today as a society, because I feel we live in a throwaway society. We go and buy an axe that's been made abroad that could have a plastic handle to it. So if that axe became blunt, we couldn't knock it off the shaft and harden and temper it, because it's been glued on, it's been moulded on. But the old axes, the rusty old axes that we see for sale for hardly any money, because we discarded them, as they're no good, they've got no handle and they're rusty. They can be put into the forge, hardened and tempered, and go on a new shaft. You could go into the hedgerow and get a piece of ash and whittle it down to make a handle, and that axe will go on for your lifetime and other lifetimes. So as a blacksmith, in that way of thinking, it is open scope. The potential and the benefits from that craft are endless, and that they always will be. I'm not actually online or anything at the moment, because I live in a horse-drawn Botox gypsy wagon, and I've been living like that for some years now. So now I'm a little bit living back in the past, not so much the Bronze Age in that way, but I mean, I am using my heavy horse to work on the land. So COSIRA and the Rural Development Commission, that used to be based in Salisbury, there was lots of books published to support the heritage of the craft that you can still get today. One of them's called Blacksmith Craft, which is an amazing little book, to just an insight of the ancient ways of forging. But an organisation's Worshipful Company of Blacksmiths, I'm a member of, and they've been active for quite some time, I think like 1326 for royalty, so protecting the blacksmith. So and their motto is, by hammer and hand all arts do stand.
Well, that's all for this week. Dialect is a weekly podcast for your MP3 player, produced by volunteers and broadcast on Bristol Community FM 93.2 at 12 p.m. every Tuesday lunchtime. If you're outside Bristol and on the internet, you can subscribe to our RSS feed or email list, which will remind you every Thursday when Dialect goes online. You can sign up for that or download this weekly podcast from our website, dialectradio.co.uk. Dialect is a Bristol Radio Co-op production, and anyone can contribute. If you'd like to do so, please contact us through Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733, which you can find on the web at bristolvolunteers.org.uk. Thank you for listening. So, until the same time next week, goodbye.
I'm girl I know needs some shelter. She don't believe anyone can help her. She's doing so much harm, doing so much damage. But you don't want to get involved. You tell her she can't manage. Now you can't change the way she feels, but you could put your arms around her. If you left him just the way you found him, I'll stand in front of you. I'll take the force of the blow.
Part of the deal, that's the way I feel.